Case number 15-7027, Candace Miles, appellant v. Howard University. Mr. Woodfield for the appellant, Mr. Prywest for the appellee.
May it please the court, Nicholas Woodfield on behalf of the appellant Candace Miles. In the district court's opinion below, it does not apparently credit the facts submitted by Ms. Miles on pages 2 through 6 of her summary judgment opposition, which is located at JA 677-681. The same facts are set forth virtually verbatim on pages 2 through 9 of the appellant's opening brief. Rather, in its memorandum opinion, the district court apparently relied on the statement of facts offered, the statement of facts not in dispute, offered by the defendant, of which there were 144 submitted in total. Plaintiff admitted to 84 of them, and the court cited those as the basis for its findings. The problem is the plaintiff below, Ms. Miles, the appellant here, contested 60 of them, but also proffered substantial evidence in support of her own case, and the court did not consider those facts, including the facts going to the issues of control by Howard, including Charlie Mahone, then the dean of UDC's School of Business Administration, testifying that once the lead center recommended Miles, UDC was, quote, not free to object to her appointment as the center director, and that's at 797 of the joint appendix.
Can I ask a question about your legal theory? I just want to make sure I've got your legal theory here correct, or the law and the facts together, and that is your view is that all the concerns about deficiencies and whatnot didn't matter. It's when she took leave that everything changed, and that was the cause of her discharge.
That is correct.
Everything was the same before. They had problems before and after, and that was the one factor that made the difference here.
Well, yes, and the standard, being a but-for standard, would be the straw that broke the camel's back, effectively. And the historical record of these small business centers was unacceptable to Howard for years. It was unacceptable to the Small Business Administration for years, and it is admitted that UDC's was marginally lower than the next lowest performing. However, that was not an issue, and as evidenced in the correspondence issued by Mr. Brown, which was the contemporaneous correspondence, not the testimony after the fact, but the contemporaneous correspondence, you have an email sent on March 14, 2011, where he already knew that the Small Business Administration wanted a remediation plan, was unhappy with the performance of all of the small business centers, and he was going around to each one of them successively saying, we need to come up with a plan to improve our performance.
Right, so I guess your view is that this isn't a mixed motive case, it's that you can't have the taking of leave under the FMLA be the straw that breaks the camel's back. It cannot be the factor that becomes the decision-making factor.
Yes.
Okay.
And in the email, which is a JA-682, Mr. Brown said, so how long are you going to be out on FMLA leave? Do you take it, and I'm trying to remember exactly the facts, but he said, or does UDC allow you 6 weeks, 8 weeks? What's the issue in which he acknowledged his lack of familiarity with the FMLA being a law in the DC FMLA, which allows you up to 16 weeks of leave. On April 7th, that is when he came forward and accused.
Sorry, what was the page that you said that is?
The email is at 682, JA-682.
I think I have that on 682.
Forgive me. Oh, 7. Hold on a second. 862. I've juxtaposed. I apologize. 862.
All right. Thank you.
Um, which is where Mr. Brown had written to Candace Miles, and he said, with regard to your leave, I have two questions. What is UDC's FMLA policy? Is it 60 or 90 days? My second question is about your clients. What accommodations have you made to continue servicing your clients while you are on leave? Can you provide a brief response? There is no suggestion there that he's thinking, we need to get rid of Ms. Miles, her performance is inadequate. When you go to the next letter, which is the April 7, 2011 letter, which is JA 866, on the second page at 867, the third bullet point down, Mr. Brown, in criticizing the UDC program, starts by noting the service center director is currently on maternity leave. She took leave without prior notification to the executive director. Now, Ms. Miles was sent off on maternity leave early because of a risk to her carriage of her child. She was not expecting to take maternity leave at the time she had to start. It said she failed to make any meaningful provision of the continuation of client services at the UDC Service Center, and we have proffered evidence to the contrary in our evidentiary submission. Moreover, the Service Center failed to communicate to the executive director specific date and time for returning to work. The center director has essentially abandoned the Service Center and its clients by her failure to take the necessary and proper steps to assure viable operation of the Service Center. Further, the center
director... That doesn't sound like the leave is a problem. That sounds like her failure to have made any plans for being out was the problem. FMLA doesn't protect you from that, does it?
Your Honor, we have submitted that she did make adequate plans. She had planned to have the other service centers service their clients, such as the other service centers had always done in the absence of their directors.
Had she given notice to anybody that these other service centers that they were going to have to pick up for her?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where's that in the record?
I thought
she admitted that she was supposed to submit a plan but hadn't.
She had the plan, and Mr. Haig had also mentioned that in his declaration, and I will find that for you, Court. Mm-hmm.
If it's going to take long now, you can just do it on rebuttal.
Okay, I will do that on rebuttal. But I would point, in looking at this and trying to figure out what happened here, because I looked at the district court's opinion and trying to figure out why there's such a dearth of facts relating to Ms. Miles's case in chief, essentially her factual proffer. And I noted that in his opinion, in the district court's opinion below, he relied virtually entirely on the facts that Ms. Miles admitted in his opinion is the factual basis for finding that there was no control exercised by Howard. He relied on the facts that she admitted of the proffered factual submission by Howard. Again, as I noted, she admitted about 84 of the 144. And he made his decision based on that. Now, she made an entirely substantial factual proffer separate and apart from what she acknowledged of their facts, of Howard's facts, and those facts are not set forth in the opinion. And I would submit that under the Tolan v. Cotton decision, is error because effectively
what is the most important fact or facts that she proffered that the district court overlooked?
I would submit that they are found in the district court brief, in the brief below, at pages 2 through 6 of her summary judgment opposition at 677 to 681, but including Charlie Mahone, the dean of the business school, saying UDC was not free to object to her appointment as the center director, the fact that Miles reported directly to the executive director of the lead center.
This is on the joint employer issue?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, what is your key fact on the question of failure to create a summary judgment level disputed fact as to whether or not there was pretext on the part of Howard?
Because Howard did not mention terminating Ms. Miles well into until April, until she was about 6 weeks into her FMLA leave, and that is found in the JA 876, May 11th, 2011. And at that point, it became the issue that 876. At that point, Howard had, who had previously said, and in the letter as of April 11th, said you may want to think about getting a new director. When Mr. Dean Mahone came forward and said we're not going to replace her because we believe that would be illegal to fire her because she's on FMLA leave, that was what his response was. Howard came back in response and said you are either going to hire a new director or we're going to cut off the program, and that is found at 877, where he said that UDC's failure to provide a meaningful and concrete recovery plan detailing how the UDC's SBDC Center will be brought into compliance with your contracted agreement with Howard University is called a default. And then in bold it says, this will trigger termination procedures in 30 days unless you agree in writing in 7 days from the date of this letter to the following non-negotiable conditions.
Doesn't that letter show that it wasn't because she was on leave, it was a failure to have a recovery plan? That was what was causing them to want these changes.
Well, the recovery plan is separate and apart from the reason that that Howard would proffer before for why Ms. What Mr. Brown was saying before. Mr. Brown was saying that she didn't give adequate notice as to how the cases were going to be referred to each other. Here, Mr. Brown is saying that because because UDC did not agree to terminate Ms. Miles as part of the recovery plan, he did not believe it was adequate. And then he leads off with seven factors that he articulates specifically, the first one being provide appropriate new leadership for the center within 60, and then he says in a parenthetical 30 days, subject to the local the lead center's approval, restructure the lead center. And then on the fifth one it says the new center director will submit to the lead center a proper recovery plan and marketing plan within 1 month. The problem is, if you look at the contemporaneous correspondence, you look at J866 juxtaposed with 877, he starts off by accusing Ms. On April 7th, accusing Ms. Miles of abandoning her post by not giving adequate warning. And then here he's saying that if you don't terminate her, we are going to get rid of the program. Now, he didn't say we're going to get rid of the program because of bad performance. He said, you need to terminate her and we will continue the program. And so it became an issue of getting rid of Ms. Miles at that point. And the one thing that I would submit is that documents can be read two ways. The fact that this can be construed in favor of Howard's explanation does not mean that it should be, because the facts at this stage should be construed in both ways. And here he has accused Ms. Miles of abandoning the service center by taking FMLA leave because she was sent to maternity leave by her physician.
I'm sorry, did you have another point you wanted to make? Otherwise, we'll hear from Howard. We'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay.
May it please the court, Dan Priebus for Appellee Howard University. The decision below should be affirmed. There were no disputed genuine issues of material fact. The court below reviewed the abundant number of undisputed facts, 84 paragraphs undisputed, and considered all the evidence proffered by the appellant, Ms. Miles, in her brief. And the court's decision below addresses the key factors that my colleague here has addressed, and addressed them satisfactorily and demonstrated why they do not present a material issue of fact. It's simply inaccurate what you've been told, that everything changed once Ms. Miles went out on FMLA leave. And the record is very clear, and these facts are undisputed. A year earlier, in December 2009, when the UDC Service Center was unproductive, there was consideration given to closing that center. Later, in 2010, the accrediting agency told Howard University that the UDC Service Center was especially problematic. There are undisputed facts, and there are numbers 81 and 82, that managers at the Howard Lead Center found fault with Ms. Miles' performance. Even UDC's...
Well, what is your answer to their argument? You could look at that story one of two ways. One is enough time came and enough is enough. Now the SBA is breathing down our neck. We're going to lose these whole things. We've got a clean house. We have to start all over again. And the other way to look at it is, nobody was doing anything. No one seemed to care until she went on leave, and then you do have some uncomfortable statements in the record about, well, no one else had, taken maternity leave
before.
Well,
it wasn't when she went on leave that things started to happen. It was back in December 2010 before she had told anyone she was going on leave. I mean, let's face it, there were two trains here going on parallel tracks. And the one train was that this center, that this whole network was going to be shut down completely. And that had nothing to do with Ms. Miles's leave. And that train was on a roll. There was a tremendous momentum there. A new director came in at Howard to try to turn things around. What does he find? The whole network's in disarray, and the worst performing center is UDC, and it's been worst performing for 2 years. There's no one there counseling clients. The SBA comes in February, and this is before Ms. Miles goes out on leave and says, you've got to take some drastic action. You've got to restructure your operations. So the new director comes in. He sees that UDC is the worst performing center, and he takes action. And he observes that there is not continuity, that center is sitting there empty with, being financed by $100,000 in federal taxpayer dollars doing nothing. Now, the question here is, we have to apply the Brady standard. Howard presented a legitimate business reason for its actions. That's undisputed. Howard had a reasonable basis for that belief. I don't think that's undisputed. I don't think that's challenged. Howard had an honest belief in its reasons. If you look at the...
is challenged.
Well, I think if you look at, I believe it's number 105, Mr. Brown, it was undisputed that Mr. Brown believed that UDC's performance was deficient at that point in time, and that the continuity plan that Ms. Miles had put together was deficient. So there is no dispute that there was a sincere belief on the part of Howard University that that the performance was deficient. And with all that being so, there was no reason whatsoever for the court to withhold summary judgment. The Brady standard was met. And let me just say, and this goes back to the Glecklin case that Judge Randolph decided some time ago, let's talk about the plausibility of Ms. Miles' position. Is it really plausible that Howard decided to shut down a service center that had been around for 10 years, where the director, the dean at UDC, had worked with the dean at Howard for something like 18 years? Is it really plausible that Howard shut down that service center because the director went out on family medical leave? That's not a plausible explanation. It's far more plausible that Howard's explanation is the correct one, and for the same reasons as in Glecklin, this court should affirm that ruling. We didn't spend too much time on the joint employer-employment issue. That issue, of course, is dispositive in and of itself. And once again, the court below had ample basis for its ruling. And we didn't hear anything about the dismissal of the Title VII and DCHRA claims. And I think that that the dismissal there's not even any question about it. In fact, there wasn't even any challenge in the appeal as to the trial court's finding that there was no evidence of discriminatory animus based on gender, pregnancy, or family responsibilities. There was no evidence of any discriminatory comments. There was no evidence that any women or other pregnant women or people with families were treated badly. Just the opposite. All the evidence here is that Howard cleaned house. It terminated its second most senior executive at the Howard Lee Center. He was a male. It had pressured the prior director of the Howard Lee Center to retire because of concerns about his performance. And it had even criticized the preceding director of the UDC Service Center and had encouraged UDC to terminate him. So there was nothing going on. There's no evidence here of any adverse animus based on FMLA leave, pregnancy, gender, nothing whatsoever. And that's why the trial court found there were no disputed issues of fact and correctly dismissed the case.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Whitfield, we'll give you a couple minutes.
Thank you, sir. I refer the court to Mr. Haig's declaration, which is found at JA 850. The second page, which is 851, the court will tell me. If you want me to wait for you, I will.
That's okay. You can keep talking.
Paragraph 15 of his declaration, Mr. Haig, who was the director of the Anacostia Economic Development Corporation Business Development Center, which was the Anacostia counterpart to the UDC Center, at paragraph 15 on 851 says, in about September of 2009, Miles approached me and told me she was pregnant and expected to give birth in April 2011. Over the course of the next several months, Miles informed several staff members, both at UDC and throughout the DC-SBDC network, of her pregnancy and her anticipated maternity leave absence. 17. Miles disseminated this information to the AEDC so that people could plan for Miles to be absent during the course of her pregnancy. 18. Miles contacted me, and we made arrangements so that in her absence, her clients would be referred to the AEDC service center, as the AEDC was able to temporarily absorb the additional clients. We did this because referring clients between the service centers is an operational practice of the DC SBDC network and was facilitated by the DC SBDC Standard Operating Procedure Manual's guidance on record storage. In fact, we were trained that referring clients between the service centers should be an operational practice for the DC SBDC network. Accordingly, Howard's lead center and the service centers occasionally referred clients between different DC SBDC centers based upon the client's needs and the availability of resources at each center. I would submit that there was planning going on for a substantial amount of time. Mr. Brown, Howard first raised the issue, and Mr. Brown raised the issue, but Howard raised the issue for the very first time of potentially terminating Ms. Miles because
of... Can I ask you about paragraph 15?
Yes, sir.
How can that be?
Yeah, that was going to be my question. The math doesn't add up.
Is that a typo? Is it supposed to be 2010?
I would assume that that is an error because she started working there in 2011. Or 2009, forgive me. But no, I believe that it should be 2011.
What should be?
September of 2011. I agree.
But she was going to, in September of 2011, she informed that she was going to give birth in April 2011?
Forgive me, sir. 2010. My wife would kill me at this point for the matter. but no, I believe it was. She learned at roughly September preceding the April 2011, and that I think is clearly a typographical error. But he then said here that they continued to make plans over the preceding months prior to her departure. I would also note that the first time Howard University ever raised the issue of potentially terminating Ms. Miles was April 7, 2011. She went out on FMLA leave on March 7, 2011. And informed UDC immediately. She informed Mr. Brown on March 14, 2011. Under the FMLA, when you are out, if you've got an employer who makes a decision to terminate you, then the onus is on the employer at that point to explain why the reason is reasonable at that point when you're firing someone there that is out on leave. The decision wasn't made until she was out to terminate her, as evidenced by the contemporaneous emails. And as evidenced by Mr. Brown's own testimony, where he acknowledged that he had not decided to terminate her before April 7, 2011. Now, the fact that
this is somewhat off the point, but the argument that it reminds me of a statement that Chief Justice Marshall made about the repeal of the Circuit Court Act in about 18 whatever early. He says you can't remove the judge from the court, but you can remove the court from the judge. And that's basically what what your argument is here.
Well, I'm gonna confess to not being enough of a student of the law in that particular aspect. But what I would say is the fact that Mr. Brown made the decision to terminate Ms. Miles, had he made it before he was told that she was taking FMLA leave, we would have an entirely different case. But the problem is he came in and first questioned her how long she was going to be out. This was a situation where Howard is saying, we're in an emergency here. What are we going to do? And he comes forward and says, how long are you going to be out? 60 days? 70 days? How long?
Well, I think he said, what is the policy they have? Right? But that's a perfectly sensible question there.
It is, but the problem is he doesn't make the decision to terminate her until after that, which suggests to me, as a fact finder, as a potential fact finder, that he's looking at this and saying she's going to be out too long, and we need to replace her. And that is consistent with the fact.
It was 60 or 90. It wasn't, Judy. He was just trying to figure out how many months it was.
That's true. But at that point, he's asking her when she's returning, and then he subsequently is making the demands in the subsequent correspondence saying you may want to think about replacing her in his April 7th correspondence. And then as a condition precedent to keeping the center open, he's saying replace her, put someone else new in. And so what he's doing is he's saying I'm not going to wait. And under the DCFMLA, she's entitled to 16 weeks, which is roughly 112 days by my math off the top of my head. And he wasn't willing to wait till she could come back. And he was saying, we need someone in there. We need someone in there permanently. We want to make sure they're the right person. That is a factual scenario that we put forward as a viable reason for why he terminated her, because he didn't want to wait for her to return. It wasn't because of her performance at the time, because at the time, he wasn't criticizing her performance, saying it's terminable up until April 7th.
Okay. Thank you. The case is submitted.
Thank you.